is from the archives from 2015. I am playing it today in memory of Jean Valentine and her wonderful life and poems. I've been thinking about Jean Valentine a lot these last couple of weeks and wanted to share this episode with you all. I am grateful for this conversation, and I hope you will enjoy it today too. From the 2015 archives, in memory of Jean Valentine.
I find it very, very easy to be true. I find myself alone when each day's through. Yes, I'll admit that I'm a fool for you. Because you're mine, I walk the line.
Good afternoon. You've got Living Writers. I'm T. Hetzel, and today I'm so thrilled to have in the studio Jean Valentine. We're taping the show. It's February 12th, 2015, and Jean has just flown in from West Texas en route back to New York City. We've got Stephanie Engineering behind the glass. And Jean, welcome. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks so much for having me. It's wonderful to be here.
Even in this freezing winds that we that were battering us as we strode towards the station.
Makes a change from Texas.
It does. And then by the time you get back to New York City, you'll be like, oh, this isn't so cold right. Over here. This isn't so bad. Jean, we've got from Copper Canyon Press, 2010, Break the Glass, a book of poems. We also have on the table New and Collected Poems, 1965 through 2003, Door in the Mountain. And you have a new collection coming out with Copper Canyon Press in maybe this May.
Yes, we're hoping.
And what do what's the title of that one going to be?
It's called Shirt in Heaven.
Well, then maybe we'll talk again in May, shall we?
Oh, I'd love that.
With you. Okay.
Wonderful.
So we won't worry about, we're getting everything in today. Before we go any further, I'll read a short bio from your website, Jean. I got to say, I love the photos on the website, how you have two pictures, one from you in 2002 and one from you of you from 1972.
That's a long time.
and you have also a wonderful picture of a typewriter to start.
Oh, I know. I still use a typewriter.
Do you? What kind of typewriter do you use?
Oh, God knows. It's an old Italian one. What are they called?
Is it Olivetti?
Olivetti. I have a little Olivetti portable. Do you have one?
I do, too.
Oh, wow.
Yes. My friend Phoebe gave it to me.
Aren't they great?
They are. Oh. It's the best for, I think, starting poems. Do you find that too?
Oh, yeah,
Jean?
That's what I do, yeah. And then I type them up to see. I think they look better than they do in my scratchy handwriting, you know. Love putting them on the typewriter.
Do you start with the scratchy handwriting?
I start by
handwriting?
Hand, yeah. I start by hand. But then I love to type them up. They look so much nicer.
Yes, like the curves of the letters.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, beautiful.
It gives them a different type of voice almost.
Yeah,
Do you use, do you have sort of favorite, do you use like yellow pads or like unlined paper? Or
I love yellow pads, yeah. When I got to Marfa, it's the place I've just been where they do everything for you. And one of the things they do for you that you see first is you walk in and on the desk there's a yellow pad and probably three pencils or something.
Wow. So just in case, right?
Just in case. You get an idea.
Well, it's true. It's bad as a writer to be caught short without one of your, right? And it does happen. And that's the worst. Yeah. I don't know. Because some of those things, some of the ideas are so fleeting, even if they feel so strong, aren't they, Jean?
Absolutely. Yeah. You have to have pen and paper around.
Do. And yellow pad is your one of your tools of choice.
Oh, I adore them. Do you?
I do. Also, Well, let's see. I was going to say, even the small moleskin.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I love moleskin books.
Because they come in so many sizes.
I know. They're so comforting.
They are. I used to think they were too precious to write in, so I would just sort of carry it around, and then
they're too beautiful.
Yes. But then, as Gresham,
for human ends,
it's true, except for Hemingway.
Right.
But anyway, but you dog ear them a bit, beat them up a bit, and then you can start writing in them, right?
Right.
Jean, before I keep chatting with you here, I'll read the bio and then we'll go from there, shall we? Jean Valentine was born in Chicago, earned her BA from Radcliffe College, and has lived most of her life in New York City. She won the Yale Younger Poets Award for her first book, Dream Barker, in 1965. Her 12th book of poetry is Break the Glass, published by Copper Canyon Press in 2010. Door in the Mountain, New and Collected, Poems 1965 through 2003, was the winner of the 2004 National Book Award for Poetry. Jean was the State Poet of New York for 2 years, starting in the spring of 2008. She received the 2009 Wallace Stevens Award from the Academy of American Poets, and many awards, actually. And in 2014, she was given an award for exceptional accomplishment in literature from the American Academy of Arts and Letters. Jean has taught at Sarah Lawrence College, the graduate writing program of New York University, Columbia University, and the 92nd Street Y in Manhattan. And today, you're visiting University of Michigan.
Yes.
So you'll be here teaching students and meeting with writers and poets. And
I'm excited to be here.
Well, I'm so glad you're here. I've really been looking forward to this.
Thank you.
And Jean, so from could we think about a little bit about your story, your writing story, like what the way writing poems has been a constant in your life? When did you start finding poems and writing short pieces?
Well, I think I was lucky to be born into the family I was, because my mother read nursery rhymes to us when we were little kids, and it was very unforgettable to me. And it was one of the moments that was shared with her, because we were doing our lives and she was doing hers, but then we'd get together and she'd read us, and you know, at the end of the day, she'd read us from nursery rhymes, and I'll never forget it. And I also had an older sister who loved poetry, and so she would say, it's pronounced Yates, Jean, not Yeats. But she was mostly telling me there was such a poet as Yeats, and also other poets that she already loved, because she was that much older. And so that was a great, great help to me too, you know, and great inspiration.
And so having those rhymes and those lyrics in your mind and your imagination from such a young age.
Yeah.
So when did you start writing? Because you've got that first book came out in 1965. Had you been writing poems when you were like a young woman in high school age? And you talked about about Elizabeth Bishop being important to you too as a woman writer in amongst the many men who were teachers.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that seems to be two parts, but I'll start by saying,
a lot of questions.
Well, it's good though. They're all one, really. I think I really started loving to write maybe around the age of 12, something like that. And I got a lot of encouragement from teachers along the way.
When you were 12?
Well, you know, just writing what I thought were poems, but, you know, or wanted to think were poems. But I loved poetry, and I read it, and got a lot of encouragement from school. So I really, really love the people who go into schools and teach. And I'd love them anyway, probably, but they really encouraged me. And college, I got a lot of really wonderful encouragement in college. And I think if I hadn't, probably I wouldn't have gone on, because it's such a, and in those days, this was the 50s, I graduated from college in 56, there weren't very many well-known women poets that, by me anyway, well-known. You know, there were probably many more than I knew about, but to have someone like Marianne Moore or Miss Bishop going ahead of you really made a big difference, because it was pretty much a man's world still in the poetry I knew, which was the white middle-class poetry of that time and place.
And in America.
Very limited. And in America, not to mention God Almighty. And so I knew very little, but what I knew was mostly white male poetry. And to have the poetry of Miss Bishop, and which we called her then, and Miss Moore, God, it made a difference, you know, to know that people had made a life of it. And done both the life and done the work they did, you know, and that they had helped one another, you know, that Miss Moore had brought Miss Bishop along as a youngster. And all that was very, it made me think it might be possible, you know.
And that makes all the difference, doesn't
it? All the difference, doesn't it?
And so you kept going. So you were writing poems, mm-hmm. and...
I kept going, yeah. I got married after college and had two children and was writing away. And I'd send things out sort of fitfully, but nothing ever got taken. And this was in a much smaller poetry world than it is now, I think. But I was certainly much more shy than most of the young people I meet now who are passionate about poetry. They're more active, I think, sending things out and seeing each other, knowing each other. I was kind of isolated. But anyway, I'd had a lot of encouragement, and I got the Yale thing at the age of 30. Yeah.
So, and how important was that, having that? Because that was your first book.
It was the first poem I ever had printed.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
Stephanie's also aghast, like myself. That's
if
wonderful.
If you ever get discouraged, don't be discouraged. I think it's just all such a chance, you know. And someone had told me, oh, you should try the Yale Poetry Series, whatever it's called, Yale Series of Younger Poets. And so I did, but I really didn't have a dream, because I'd never had a poem printed. And then I got a book.
So what happens? Did someone call you up and say, Jean Valentine, we'd like to award you this? And then...
That was in the days of letters, you know. I had my kids out in the park, and I came home. We came home, and I got this letter in the mailbox. And it's a very, very formal but sweet letter. And saying, one of the things, this editor was Dudley Fitz, and he said, are you a recluse? I have never seen a poem of yours in print.
Recluses unite.
Recluses unite. So... that was a wonderful day, and he and I became great friends, and he became a mentor to me, very much so. In fact, I can't believe how much patience and time he put into that first book. Very, very kind man.
And then that, after that book came out and you held it in your hands, did that mean the deal was sealed? You were going to keep on keeping on with these poems?
I'm not sure it was quite like that. I think I would have kept on anyway, just for my, well, who knows, you know.
But composure, or just something you have to do.
It was very encouraging. I think I would have had to do something or other, but it was very encouraging. And two things happened I would love to say just very quickly. I didn't know a single poet in my life except the teacher that I had had, and... within, I'd say, a few months, Adrian Rich got in touch with me, who was not that much older, but much more established, and a very, as you know, very important
a force.
Citizen as well as poet, and great poet, I think. She got in touch with me, and we talked on the phone some, and ultimately we met and became very close friends. But that was the first poet of my own, who wasn't a teacher, you know? I mean, officially a teacher. She certainly was a teacher, but who I hadn't met in school, you know, as a teacher. student relationship. And another poet in New York who I don't know if you'd know the work, but her name was Jean Cooper. She was actually a neighbor of ours. And she encouraged me, and we met, and she gave me all kinds of help, and ultimately a teaching job at Sarah Lawrence College, where she was teaching, and she got me a job there, which I kept for the rest of my life, actually. So that was two very important things that happened as a result of having a book in print. You know, I would never have known that those things could happen, or anything like them, you know.
Yes. We'll take a short break, and then we'll come right back and talk more. Today on the program, Jean Valentine is here. I'm T. Hetzel. You have Living Writers. We'll be right back.
Country boy, ain't got no shoes. Country boy, ain't got no blues. Well, you work all day while you're wanting to play in the sun and the sand with a face of tan. At the end of the day when your work is done, you ain't got nothing but fun. Country boy, ain't got no wills. Country boy, you don't owe no bills. You get a wiggly worm and then you watch him squirm while you put him in a hook and you drop him in a brook. If everything's gonna turn out right, you're gonna fry fish tonight. Country boy, got a lot to lose. Country boy, I wish I was in your shoes. Country boy, got a shaggy dog. Country boy, up a holler low. Well, he comes in a run when you pick up your gun and with a shell or two and your dog and you. When you get your rabbit, your skin is hide. He's gonna be good fried. Country boy, you got a lot to do. Country boy, I wish I was in your shoes.
Welcome back. If you're just tuning in, glad you did. I'm T. Hetzel. Today on Living Writers, Jean Valentine is here. We've got Stephanie, the behind the glass. And Jean, I really wish you could have heard Stephanie's poem that she read yesterday for fundraiser. It was a beauty.
Oh, I wish I could.
But anyway, we won't keep going on.
Maybe she'll show it to me afterwards.
We're going to twist her arm, I think.
Yeah, good.
Jean, you picked Johnny Cash as our musician for the day here to take us through the show. Why Johnny Cash?
Well, I just love him. I don't know. I don't know very many new musicians, but he breaks my heart. I just love him.
And you say that with the biggest smile.
Well, yeah, you know how it is.
Maybe also it's then you know that the broken heart is something that others feel too.
Yeah. Yeah. I love him. I saw a movie about him. I love him. I listen to him. I play him for my grandchildren, you know.
And then do you all sort of stomp around the room today? Yeah. I like that. Well, Jean, would you mind reading a poem for us?
Sure, I'd be happy. Yeah. I could read one from Break the Glass, which is the last book I published. Do you have something in mind?
Well, I'd love, I actually, would you mind at some point reading, it's so very short, so please do read from this little poem here.
Oh my goodness, how interesting. This is called Bud, and it's the name, Bud. Christmas night, my father said, "Jean, you are so disloyal." But Bud said, "No, ethereal, ethereal, but my friend." And I I got my prayer answered. I died with my life around me. I don't know if a reader could hear that, but that whole last three lines is Bud speaking. So it's Bud who says, I died with my life around me. It's a sad one.
Thank you.
You look sad. It is a sad one. It's interesting because I probably haven't even read that poem for years to myself or anything. You know, I forgot. I didn't forget it, but you know, it's an interesting one for you to have chosen. Thank you.
Thanks for reading it, Jean. I don't usually ever ask people to read poems because I just, that's one of the things I'll always say, no, you just, but thank you for reading it.
I'm glad you did. I haven't seen that one for a while. Thank you.
Is it like finding like this moment? What happens when you come back to a poem where it's been years, perhaps, that you've even thought of it or read it?
This has been many years. I don't even remember what year that book was in, but River at Wolf. I don't place it, but you know, in my memories of a person or a situation, but I do write a certain amount from dreams and from dream-like states of mind. And this feels to me like it might have been one or the other or both. You know how when you have a dream, sometimes you might get something someone says, and then you might wake up and they might say something more in your sort of half-awake state, or you might put it together a little bit with some thought of your own or something. I mean, it's all thoughts of your own, but you know what I mean. You might hook it up with something else you've been thinking about or something. That seems like that this might have been one of those poems.
When you say that you sort of with the dream state, mm-hmm. is it often when you are literally sleeping and then you have maybe a yellow pad by your bed and you do have, or is it something that you've been able to as a practice, like kind of the sitting down and as you start thinking, is that because you're not, is that what?
You ask wonderful questions. That's really what's become for me as I've gone along. I used to start with actual dreams. In fact, I had a teacher in college who said to his little workshop of 14 of us or something, you could write from your dreams, you know, or something like that.
Just sort of
wonderful man, Edwin Honig. And he changed my life by saying that because I began to write from my dreams. I'd always been in, well, I had at least at that time gotten interested in dreams. And I just have... It was like giving me a whole world to make notes from that I might not have thought of before without him.
Because it was already your world, it was yours, but maybe not seeing it for a fuel for the ideas
exactly.
or the writing.
I was very, very young in poetry, in my own poetry. I didn't know what I could do and what I couldn't. And now I think there's nothing you can't do. But then I didn't know that. You know, I was 20 or something. I thought there were things you could do and things you couldn't. You know, I was very young. And so that was very liberating and wonderful for him to say. And I think I was writing literally from dreams more in the maybe middle. I don't know where I am now, but anyway, I'd say this. Nowadays, I'm writing more from dream-ish states than I am from actual dreams. You know, I still dream a lot, but I think I'm not actually taking them down as much now as being in that state a lot more, you know, and writing from that. I don't know if you
and
can
pieces,
see the difference, but
no, yes,
yeah, I'm
yes.
not
and do
maybe articulating
no,
it.
No, you
but,
are. No, no. Do you find that it's in sort of the more dream state that pieces come to you, because perhaps the Lucy poems might be would that be an example of
God knows where she came from? That was one long dream because I wrote that thing in about 2 days. That was amazing.
And is that in the new book that's coming out in May, or is that in Break the Glass, Jean?
I think she's in Break the Glass. Let me just, yeah, she is. She's the last section in Break the Glass, I think. I got a lot of Lucy here if you want to hear one. Or
yes, would you tell us the story?
Sure. I'll tell you the story, yeah. I was, again, I've been so fortunate. I was at one of these writing places, and so I was all in the silence and wondering and happy, and it was summertime, and deer and turkeys were coming up to the house that I was in, and
turkeys, too.
And wild turkeys and wild deer, and it was just wonderful for a New Yorker to be in such a place, you know. But I was reading the Orpheus poems of Rilke, and I think that had something to do with it, because he's so powerful, and he gets under your skin, and I've read those poems a lot, so I was at home in them, sort of. And
I love that, and home in them.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
I don't know German, but I was at home in the translation, and so what happened was I looked at this magazine article, and there was this article about Lucy, who's a hominid between the apes who were on all fours and the apes who stood up. She was one of the first ones who stood up, and I think she's called a hominid. And one of the things that meant, this article explained, was that the mothers, the females, would be able to hold their babies because they were walking on their hind legs, so to speak, and they had arms to hold their baby. And the whole story was sort of a miracle, how they found her and everything. But I think the mother feeling that came to me from her was very strong, almost unbeknownst to me. I could go on and on about this, but what happened was
But the mother feeling,
yeah,
you were saying.
The mother feeling is very strong, and I welcomed that. And what else was I going to do? But, you know, it was very strong to me in my own life. And so that was a time, I don't remember quite how this conversation started, but that was a time when I was, the only time in my life, I think, where I got a long thing just absolutely dictated. I mean, I didn't have much to do with it, honestly. And I've never, never had anything like that happen. It's a fairly long thing. And I suppose that's how some poets are, you know. A lot of the time, I'm sure Rilke was. But for me, that was the first thing.
Oh, that's interesting.
Don't you think? Yeah, like those Orpheus poems just seem to have come directly from God through Rilke to us, you know, through his ear.
Yes. But then you're saying, because you were in those poems, that's how this Lucy sequence came
to you. I think that helped a lot, being in that, you know, Orpheus world of his is so inspiring, you know.
And that did it, was it for several days, Jean?
A couple of days. So about a day and a half, but including a night, you know, so.
And did you keep writing through the night?
Yeah. Yeah.
So you kept writing.
Once I started, yeah. I did. I love when things come, so I wouldn't consider anything else, you know, if it's coming to you. Would you?
Just keep. That's a good question. I feel like I should say, no, of course not. But then I feel like life pulls on you.
It does pull on you. I was lucky because I didn't have any family around me. I didn't have a job. I was in this state of being in an artist colony with nothing to do.
Because that was really, you know, that was sort of your job to do.
It was my job and my family and everything. It was everything. I just didn't have anything to do but sit there and write things down.
So it was the right moment to
perfect.
Keep listening.
Perfect moment.
I hope you were eating.
Don't worry about me eating. But it was interesting. I got almost alarmed by it because I'd never had anything this long come to me. And what would be the alarm? I suppose sometimes happiness can be alarming, you know?
Which sounds strange to say.
Very strange to say, but I went up and called a friend on the phone and read her some of it. I said, I don't know what's going on with me, but this thing keeps coming. And she said, I think there's more. Go back and write the rest of it. And she said, just don't operate any heavy machinery.
Good counsel.
Johnny would like that, right? Johnny Cash.
Or he might even be like, just give it a go.
Yeah, right.
Well, you know what? On that note, let's hear a little more Johnny.
Okay.
We'll take a short break. Today on Living Writers, Jean Valentine is here. We've got her book, Break the Glass, out with Copper Canyon Press on the table with us. We'll be right back.
Now I taught the weeping willow how to cry, and I showed the cloud how to cover up a clear blue sky. And the tears that I cried for that woman are gonna flood you, big river, and I'm gonna sit right here until I die. I met her accidentally in St. Paul, Minnesota, and it tore me up every time I heard her drawl, southern drawl. Then I heard my dream went back downstream, cavorting in Davenport, and I followed you, big river, when you called. Oh, St. Louis, later on down the river. A freighter said she's been here, but she's gone, boy, she's gone. I found her trail in Memphis, but she just walked up the bluff. She raised a few eyebrows and then she went on down alone. Now won't you bat it down by Baton Rouge, River Queen, roll it on. Take that woman on down to New Orleans, New Orleans. Go on, I've had enough. Dump my blues down in a gulf. She loves you, big river, more than me.
Welcome back. You've got Living Writers. I'm T. Hetzel. Today, Jean Valentine is here, playing some Johnny Cash. Thanks to Stephanie. Making the choices. Jean said, let's listen to some Johnny. And then we were all just like, that's entirely the right thing to do. Isn't it? Jean, so we were talking about Lucy before the break, the poem. And then during the break, you were telling me a little bit about how it was this experience that felt so unusual. And I was wondering, would you mind saying a bit more about it? And maybe you could even read part of Lucy for us, too.
Sure, I could. It was unlike any experience I've had before or since. And one of the interesting things that happened, too, was that I had seen a untaught painter. I think there's better words for them, but I'd seen his work, and he came into the poem, and it's just, he was as unbidden as Lucy was. I'm just fiddling here to get his name. Outsider Art, Martin Ramirez. I don't know if you know his work. He came into the poem, just walked in, you know. It was just like, I can't describe it. If you were describing it, you might say you were sitting in the audience and a play was going on or something, and you just took it down because that's what you did. You know, you just wrote it down. And she came and then he came. And what they have to do with one another, I'm still not sure.
But you trust your subconscious.
I do, totally, yeah. I have nothing else to trust, you know. You look like you know what I mean.
I do.
And Stephanie knows what I mean. We're laughing here in the radio room, but actually it is what I have to trust when I'm writing. And probably in life, you know, the intuition. I think it's what we have for the kind of poetry I write. It isn't everybody, but, you know, for me, it is.
And maybe also as a way of being.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I hope so. Yeah.
T.
intuition. I don't really figure things out very well, as you could see when you came to meet me at the hotel. But I'm not good at finding things in the practical world, but I do think that as a consequence or as a gift, I've been given some intuition.
Oh, I love that. Jean, will you read some of Lucy so that we can hear this gift that you said sort of just came and you wrote it down?
Yeah.
And that's an extraordinary thing.
It is a gift.
You also weren't thinking of the future, like what was going to happen with it as you were writing it down. And
you know, I almost never do anyway, but in this case, you couldn't. You know, you were just sort of like hypnotized or something. You know, it's just happening. This is how it began. Lucy, your secret book that you leaned over and wrote just in the dirt, not having to have an ending, not having to last. Just what you just said, actually. Not having to have an ending, not having to last. That's exactly how it felt. And there's a quotation. This isn't a quotation. This is the next poem that came along. Two hands were all you owned for food, for love. Now you own none, Lucy, nor no words, only breath marks only, nor no words. Or what do you do now, Lucy, for love, your eyes? I honestly don't have anything but respect for this, because it's as if someone else did write it, I think, you know. It's wonderful how you can get outside your own self sometimes, isn't it, when you're writing, or probably any art, or maybe many other experiences besides art, you know. I'd like to read you one about Martine, who is this outsider artist who came into it. Whoops, sorry.
That's okay. That one's a tricky one.
I'd like to say something about Martine.
Oh, please.
Ramirez, this outsider artist who came into it. He felt, I think, this is getting conscious about it, but he felt like a sort of, thinking of who these people might be to me, she felt like a complete other, but like a muse, sort of, in the sense of she literally mused. She told me what to write. He came along, sort of as a friendly fellow traveler on the surface of the world, not used in any other sense, but a fellow comrade, sort of a comrade. This morning I miss most of all you, Martine, and her. Now, this is getting off into imagining his mother. This morning I miss most of you, most of all you, Martine, and her who, when you were born, looked and blessed your beauty. Lucy, when you are with me, I feel the atoms racing everywhere in this old oak table, in the eight-pointed double star spider, and in the starry rippling all around us. Skeleton woman, guardian, death woman, Lucy, here a picnic, cornbread, here an orange, with Martine and me at the lip of the Earth's surface world. That's the last one of that sequence, I think. Yeah.
Of the Lucy sequence.
Yeah. Yeah. So they sort of draw together, and we're all together at the end, you know.
How were you able to, like, did you know it was the end?
I didn't really know. I waited and saw, but nothing else came. I would still love something else to come, but, you know, you can't do anything about that.
Because, and it might not be Lucy next time.
I know. I know.
So what did come, Jean? Because you have this new collection coming out. Shirt of Heaven?
Shirt in Heaven.
Shirt in Heaven.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what was happening since we left off then with Lucy?
I'm afraid I didn't bring anything of the new book with me. I brought some new poems, but there'd be the book after that. I suppose I'm going to give a reading today later, and I'd read some of the ones from the coming book, Shirt in Heaven. But I don't suppose you could paste those onto this interview, could you? I don't seem to have anything from
what would you like
the
to
next
read, Jean?
Book.
That's okay. I don't know why I was being.
No, but that's very interesting.
Because I love this idea that there was this thing that happened, and then it sort of became the end of the book, even though you were still writing poems, you know, all around it.
That's
probably.
Right. This did it become the end of the book? Yeah, I think it did. It became the end of this book, yeah. Yeah. You know, partly, I think, honestly, for me anyway, it gets to be the end of the book when you have enough pages.
I like that. It's very practical. I like that. Because people are like, oh, this feels like this is in this book. And I'm like, how many books do you have?
God, it's to me much more kind of, can I send it off to Michael yet?
Yeah, you know? And isn't he lovely?
Oh, yeah.
Michael Wieger.
Absolutely lovely. Yeah. And
Joseph and all the guys and all the gang at Copper Canyon
you
Press.
You know them all, yeah. Yeah, they're wonderful. So I guess I could read you some that I think are from What Will Happen Next. Which is maybe one more poem? Or?
That would be great.
Yeah. This is one I'm very fond of. It's called Notes from a Lecture by Sir Roger Penrose. And this isn't quite Lucy, but I turned the radio on one day, and I don't know if you ever do this. There was this wonderful British voice, and he was lecturing about the Big Bang and things like that that I knew nothing about. And I was transfixed. It was kind of like Lucy, who I also knew nothing about, except this is available, but, you know, I didn't know. Anyway, I'll read it. These were just things he said that I wrote down. Before the Big Bang came the remote future. Out of the heaviness, turning, then opening, spreading like fast water, open, crossover. It's hard to talk about what you know. Sir Roger is projecting transparencies. His hand-drawn diagrams look like breasts and fields of tipping hourglasses. Before us came the remote future, a succession of eons. But you don't have to worry about that. The join is perfectly smooth. It doesn't look smooth from this angle, but it is. That's a little wonderful, isn't it?
That's a great one.
The thing is, some of that came from, I guess it's the computer. A friend of mine got him on the computer for me after that so that I could see him lecturing. And he's the kind, some of this stuff he never said, but I made it up. But he did say before the Big Bang came the remote future, which absolutely blew me away.
Yes,
isn't
yes.
that wonderful?
The remote, yeah, after the beginning, the remote future.
So he did
in that
say that. Swim around in that for a while. And he did have these transparencies. But some of the stuff I put in, and I hope he won't mind if he ever saw it, but I don't think he will. Anyway, he's the most, you just fall in love with him when you see him teaching. He's lecturing to a huge audience of physicists, and he's as kind as if he was teaching little children. And he says things like, before us came the remote future, a succession of eons. Then he'll say, he'll look at the audience and say, but you don't have to worry about that. The join is perfectly smooth. It doesn't look smooth from this angle, but it is. You know, it's like he's talking to a child and say, it's going to be all right. You know, he's just...
I guess we all have to hear that.
We do, and especially,
times.
I think, in his field, you know, but maybe in all fields. It's just, He's a very, very kindly teacher, and I was very lucky to find his voice on the radio. And
takes one to know one, Gene Valentine.
Well, you're very good.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll be right back for more today, more conversation with Gene Valentine. You've got Living Writers. We'll be back.
Like a bird on a wire, like a drunk in a midnight choir, I have tried in my way to be free. Like a fish on a hook, like a knight in some old-fashioned book, I have saved all my ribbons for thee. And if I have been unkind, I just hope you will let it go by. And if I have been untrue,
you've got Living Writers. I'm T. Hetzel today. Gene Valentine is here. Wow, that Johnny Cash song, that was, it's always hard to start turning down the volume on Johnny.
I know.
You know, that song, thanks for picking that one, Stephanie. That was, and it was all thanks to you, Gene, for suggesting. You just said it like you just were like, Johnny Cash.
Well, we all seem to like the idea. And who wouldn't?
So you were saying you were just in Marfa.
I was in Marfa, Texas, and again with, I've been very lucky in my life. I was again with a stretch of time to do nothing but write, read, walk, do whatever I wanted. And this poem came to me quite early on. I was sitting in front of a beautiful photograph of the work of a resistor, an artist resistor named Fernando Traverso, in Rosario, Argentina. And during the terrible times, the dirty war there, he began to stencil bicycles, make stencils of bicycles on the walls like graffiti. And another thing that he did was the bicycles were what the resistors were riding around. That was their symbol of themselves, and it was also, I mean, it's what they had, but it was also, it became a symbol of the resistors, and it became a symbol with Fernando Traverso for the disappeared. And it, for the people as well, it became, every time you saw a bicycle or every time you saw one of his stenciled bicycles, they became symbols of someone who was gone. And this photograph was right in front of my desk. It was like a window that you look out of, except I was looking into it, and it just spoke to me, is the expression, I guess. It was wonderful to be looking at it all the time. And so I wrote this. Some of these words, ni uno, ni otro, nosotros, are words that were written on the wall. Then there was a heart written in black, you know, black paint on a white wall and rubbed out. And or half rubbed out. Then there was one of his stencils of a bike, a black bike, on the wall. And then there was a date, 13-8-93, Lori Te Amo. So Lori I took to be a name. And those first six lines are all from what I was looking at. And then I went on with it. But it's called After Fernando Traverso. And in my heart, it's after everyone in that time. and in all times, for that matter, who gets gets disappeared. After Fernando Traverso, I mean, I don't mean to say he's disappeared, by the way. He's fine. He's going on in his work. But for the people he speaks for, after Fernando Traverso, ni uno ni otro, nos otros, the rubbed heart, the black bicycle, stenciled on the wall, 13-8-93, Lori, te amo. The awkward leaning phone poles, old men and women resting back against the sky in blue chairs. Some sort of opening, like the dream last night, with you still living. Did you make the dream opening? Or who? I will carry you, your happiness. I am coming. To who, I don't know. Te amo. This happiness. Old life. I'm glad. All my rubbed life. I was found. I was written on a wall in air.
Thank you, Jean. That's... You just wrote that one.
Yeah. Or he did. Somebody did.
It was you. That's a beauty.
You know how it is as a poet. You see something or something comes to you and you really feel it's not your own at all, but you just happen to be at the right moment, at the right time, at the right place, and it, you know, you get blessed.
And it seems like there was that stenciled bicycle with the... and that you connected it to the dream as well, and this opening.
That was interesting. I had one of those dreams when I... It all happens, you know, if you're there. I had a dream the first night I was in Marfa about some people who I love, and... When it was one of those dreams when you wake up, you go on dreaming, you know, you're sort of still in it. And they're wonderful people. And I wrote them and I said, I thank you for being in my dream. And I told them about how happy it was and everything like that.
Because keeping company a bit.
Yeah. And what was interesting was I had completely forgotten that they themselves had been to Marfa one time. I'd completely forgotten, and it was my first night in Marfa, but I think maybe they came to say hello or something, to bless me.
And your time there.
Yeah, exactly. Welcome to Marfa.
And that's the subconscious, isn't it? Because we might not be aware, but we're absorbing.
Yeah, absolutely. All.
And I guess we are, we keep it, even though maybe it is passing through us as well. But
oh, we do. We do, yeah. It keeps us.
It keeps us.
Whatever.
And Jean, so have you, did you, because you speak about these times where you go to a certain place, like Marfa. Mm-hmm. And when I was reading poems from Door in the Mountain last night, I was reminded that you were in Ireland.
I was, yeah.
As well. Mm-hmm. And that felt like, was that over a span of time? Because it felt like Ireland returned a bit and
7 years.
Between books. Mm-hmm. Or so.
I was there 7 years. I came back and taught one semester each year. But I was living with a man over there. And so my life was over there for 7 years. Yeah.
Was it centered in Dublin or where?
No, out in the west.
Oh, out in the west?
Yeah, yeah, near Sligo. Oh. Near Sligo town. Oh. Yeah, do you know the country?
I've been to County Clare.
And, that's a beautiful
and
county.
Mauvine, it is beautiful out west there, isn't
it? It's beautiful out there.
And
remote.
The cliffs and the Atlantic.
And Benvolva and all that. Yeah.
And what's swimming underneath, right? The cold waves.
Did you? Good for you.
Oh, no, I didn't. It was, I think, a bit too cold.
Oh, it's very cold.
Not as cold as Michigan, but
that's true.
Anyway. But so Ireland was also this time, and but these, it feels like Ireland's also a place of visions. But it seems to me, Jean, you've managed to cultivate a spirit that welcomes the vision, no matter where you are.
I hope so. Knockwood.
Yes. What's your most recent vision?
Well, I suppose this fellow, Fernando Traverso, that I just read the poem, not that that's a vision. It's just something that... It does remind me a bit of Lucy, though. It came to me. I was looking at it and feeling my feelings, reading about his activities and admiring him and so forth. But then you go to a different place, sort of, you know. It's not his daily life or even his amazing miracle of a life, but you get drawn into a poem somehow. I don't know how to explain it, you know.
It just is.
Yeah, somehow, if you're lucky.
Well, and if you sort of are making the space.
I think we have to make
the
quiet
space.
Yeah, the quiet. Oh, my God, yes. Yeah. Do you get a chance to do that very often?
Well, let's not talk about that, Jean.
Oh, okay. Not on the air.
No. But I think... I love your laugh, too. This idea of silence... And you live in New York City, so it might not be the most... I mean, it's something then... that you also sort of make and inhabit, even if the rest of the world isn't silent?
I don't think it has much to do with the actual sound around you. I mean, it would if you were, knock wood, if you were in prison or someplace, the actual sounds around you could be killing. But if it's New York or Marfa, I don't think it makes a whole lot of difference.
It's a different kind of silence.
I think so, yeah. I think you could be sitting on a subway if you feel safe in the subway and it's not too... wild, you could probably go into your own thoughts pretty well if they come to you. Yeah, I think it's more of an inner thing. You know, if you're not afraid of what might come.
Yeah, what about that? Because you've said in the past, I write from things I don't understand.
Yeah. Isn't that the joy?
Yes. But it's a big thing to say, too, isn't it?
When I say, isn't that the joy, something like the artist Traverso is not joy. It's terrible suffering.
Yes.
But I think the joy that I intended was, when I said that, was the joy to share it in any possible inkling that you can, you know, to have any inkling of what it's like to be another human being. Or an animal, anything.
That empathy.
Yes.
And so that makes me think of what you said earlier, Jean, about the where you're almost coming out of the self when you're writing these poems. And so I was thinking, if you're out of the self, you're in the universe in some way.
Well, I think we are all.
I guess we are, right? Here we are.
No, but I know what you mean. I do know what you mean. Maybe more consciously we are in the universe and not in our own clothes and our own house and all that, not paying the rent or finding the radio station or whatever it is. You know, you're sort of free and it feels... I think it feels good whether you're uncovering tragedy or joy. I think it feels good because I think you're free to be open, you know, even if it's for 5 minutes.
Thank you, Jean Valentine, for talking with me today.
Thank you so much, T.
I've so loved it. Talk with you again.
Love that.
Thanks for listening, everyone, to Living Writers. Until next time.
I keep a close watch on this heart of mine. I keep my eyes wide open all the time. I keep the ends out for the tie that binds. Because you're mine, I walk the line. Mm-hmm.
find myself alone when each day's through. Yes, I'll admit that I'm a fool for you. Because you're mine, I walk the line.
WCBN FM Ann Arbor Archives. Original air date July 19, 2015 at 12 p.m. noon.